How's that? Is that any better? Instead, Pastor Dan has assigned me a parable in Luke 16, and we'll just stay within the parable the whole time. And it's one of the harder parables of the New Testament for various reasons, but I like hard parables because that means they're more interesting. So we'll just walk through that and see how it all goes. Really, it's kind of all about money, and who was it? The dancer, not Gene Rogers, Gene Kelly, I think his name was, in An American in Paris. He was asked, he's a poor artist, and one of his critics said to him, well, you know, it seems like you're obsessed with money, you're always thinking about it. And he says, well, when you don't have any, it gains a curious significance. And that's my relationship to money. So this is, you don't have to have a lot of dough to be thinking about or to have it as part of your life. I mean, if you think about it, really, there's so many things that we do with money. We save it, we look for our retirement, we deal with bills, we deal with our house. Even though we now live in a newer house, our last house was over 100 years old. And even though we live in a newer house, there's always stuff for me to fix or change or something like that, right? So an impartial observer could say that the pursuit of money and the dealing with it is, you know, the definition of our lives, if we let it be the definition of our lives. And do we have to do so? Well, of course, the Bible talks about money and not giving your heart to the pursuit of it and the gaining of it and all that sort of stuff. But it's kind of interesting. I mean, the problem with money is this, right? Unlike other addictions, so say heroin usage, you don't have to deal with heroin all your life. Like if you actually have to go and look for it, right? And you don't need it, you don't have to have it just to live your life. But food and money are two addictions that you actually have to deal with, right? So if you eat a lot like I do, you know, and you want to lose weight and gain more control of that, unfortunately, you can't just not eat food anymore because you have to deal with it every day. And it's the same with money. As you get more and more involved in it, and it does still kind of take more and more of your heart, you have to keep dealing with it. It's not like you can go, I'm off money, you know, I'm done. Like Facebook. You just decide Facebook's taking too much of your life, you can just turn it off or close the app or whatever. Money, you've got to deal with it because it's going to be part of your life the rest of your lives. So Jesus gives a parable to the disciples in Luke 16, verse 1. If you have a Bible, you can turn there. Matthew, Mark, Luke, John. There was a rich man who had a manager, and charges were brought to him that this man was wasting his possessions. And he called him and said to him, what is this that I hear about you? Turn in the account of your management, for you can no longer be manager. So in the ancient world, there were sort of two types of farmers, peasant farmers in ancient Israel who had sort of a small subsistence farm, and more tenant landed estate owners who had larger estates and servants and stuff like that. The prodigal son, his dad, was one of those guys, one of those rich guys who had a lot of dough and could have servants and do stuff like that with them. And this guy was a manager, kind of an accounts manager of sorts. It says he was wasting the landlord's money. Interestingly, similar to the parable of the prodigal son, the same term is used, the same word, prodigal son, wasted his fortune, and this guy was wasting the fortune of the landowner. So he's going to turn in his books, get kicked out. Verse 3. And the manager said to himself, what shall I do? Since my master is taking the management away from me, I'm not strong enough to dig, and I'm ashamed to beg. He felt like he had nowhere else to go. His employment opportunities back in the ancient world were pretty limited, but were they really as limited as he was making it all out? He seems to have thought there's only three professions in the known world. Even in ancient times, of course, there's many things that someone could do, but he just thought, I can't do anything else. You can kind of see him talking himself into it. Like he probably knows he's going to steal some dough, right? Like he's already got his plan figured out, but what he's going to do. But he's at that point, you know what I'm saying, where he's talking himself into doing something he knows is wrong, but I don't have a choice. I don't have a choice. I gotta rip off this guy so I can look after. Otherwise, I'll be dead. I'll die. You have a choice. I'd say to this guy, tell yourself the truth. You know what I mean? Is the road to hell paved with good intentions or just lies you tell yourself to make yourself feel better? You know, the more you tell yourself the truth and just get used to that, the more you realize when you're about to go off that narrow path, right? You're about to go off and make a bad decision or a sinful decision. You know, tyrants through the ages, Hitler, other tyrants, they've gone out and conquered other lands, killed people, taken away their stuff. Those guys often have something in common, by the way. They think they're doing the right thing. Like they think that this is needed, that Germany needed more space. This is a necessary evil. How do they get to that twisted point in their minds? Well, I think it's through little decisions like this. Eventually, you stop telling yourself the truth. Just the things you want in your head become the truth. How did they start that? Anyhow, that's what I think is going on for this guy. I think tip number one today, we're going to have several tips. Tip number one is tell yourself the truth. What's really going on? Don't. Yeah, it's funny because I work with college students all the time, and we try to just talk to them, and we do this thing called discipleship where we just talk to them about their walk with God, and this ends up being a big part of it, is they say things, and then you realize after a while they're actually lying to themselves. Okay. All right, so he's got a big plan. He's got a big plan, right? I've decided what to do. Verse 4. So that when I am removed from my management, people may receive me into their houses so I can work for them and not beg and stuff like that. So summoning his master's debtors one by one, he said to the first, "How much do you owe my master?" And the guy says, 100 measures of oil. Olive oil, very common in the ancient world. He said to him, "Take your bill and sit down quickly and write 50. I'll just give you the bill, cross it out. Rather, you'd write a new bill and you'd write that I owe 50. He said, 100 measures of oil. Then he said to another, "How much do you owe?" And he said, 100 measures of wheat. And he said, "Take your bill and write 80. Now, you may not realize this, but these are vast amounts of material. That's not immediately apparent. Okay, so 100 baths of oil, as it's sometimes translated, that's over a year's salary for a working person. So take your entire salary. That's how much this guy owed. The next one of 1,000 bushels of wheat, various translated, is even more. That's 8 or 9 years of labor that this person owned. Undoubtedly, they're also some kind of a rich guy, but it was a vast amount of money to the manager's master. And he says, "Okay, well, just write down that you owe 80, okay? And I'll just make it look like everything's cool." So you can see how the customers would have liked that. This is the kind of accounts manager I wish I had at the Home Depot when I'm going there last couple weeks buying all kinds of drywall and stuff like that. That would have been awesome. So like most things in life, you know, this is one of my reasons why I say, this isn't in the sermon, but why I say to be honest about everything you can, because sooner or later everything gets found out, no matter what it is. If you're having an affair or thinking of having an affair, tell yourself, someday my wife and all my friends are going to know what's going on. In fact, if you're a guy, you may not realize how smart women are. This is tricky, all right? Because she probably already knows you're thinking about this. So you should you should ditch it, because someday it's all going to come out. It's very hard to keep secrets, really. It's quite tricky, sooner or later. Anyhow, the dishonest accounts guy gets found out. Yeah. Verse 8. The master, his boss, commended him for his shrewdness. And Jesus then says, for the sons of the world are more shrewd in dealing with their own generation than the sons of light. Somewhat counterintuitive. I don't know if you've ever been a boss of something. I've been a boss once in a while in my life. If someone ripped me off like that, like years of wages, like hundreds of thousands of dollars, I would not give them a raise. And it's not like in the ancient world people were crazy. In fact, what just happened was so counterintuitive that modern commentators have thought this is impossible. We must have misunderstood this somehow. And so they have split in their decision of what exactly this is saying. One camp says, yeah, this guy ripped off his boss, and then his boss found out and said, you know what? You're a smart guy. I need smart guys working for me. You were in a tough situation maybe or whatever. Here's a raise or good job, right? That seems crazy. So number two, well, maybe the guy, like these managers, they'd have like their own commission, right? So he was actually writing off his commission. Or maybe, third option, maybe there was interest on the debt that totaled like 100 baths of oil. And then the accounts manager said, hey, young fella, you know, just as a way of getting you to pay the money back, we're going to write off the interest, but the principal that you owe, you still owe us. Maybe it was something like that. But that doesn't jive with the rest of the passage, because Jesus tells us that this guy is dishonest. In fact, he is unrighteous. They call him the unrighteous steward. That's literally what he's described as. So he was a bad guy. So I think we have to understand that Jesus is not telling us an actual story. This may or may not be something that could happen in the world, but it's a parable, so it's just a story, like as an illustration for other things. And sometimes he exaggerates in his parables in order to make a point. Do you remember the parable about the mustard seed? The smallest seed in the world, which a man plants in the ground, and it becomes this massive tree, and birds land in it. You guys are kind of like a mustard seed. If you had faith like a mustard seed, do you remember that? Well, I don't know if you've ever seen a mustard seed. One, it is not the smallest seed in the world, or even in the ancient world. It's very small. And two, it does not grow up to make a tree. You will not have a mustard tree. It doesn't work like that. And everyone who heard him say that knew that it wasn't true, but he's making a point. It's just a very, very small seed that you get. It's about the smallest seed a normal person would ever plant. So sometimes he kind of exaggerates, and you know that he's doing that to make a point. But wouldn't it be crazy if this guy didn't get fired and was actually commended? That's what you're left thinking. So then he analyzes all that a little bit. For the sons of the world are more shrewd in dealing with their own generation than the sons of light. What does he mean by more shrewd? So that you can see the illustration. Sons of the world, the people who don't follow God, are more shrewd than those goody-two-shoes, like all you church-going folks right now, who are following God. Those guys are smarter than you are. Well, does it mean they're smarter, like more intelligent? Like if we took an IQ test, I'd get 75 and they'd all get 85 or 100 and 105 or whatever? No, it's not like that. It's just sneakier. People in the world are willing to be sneakier in dishonest ways than you guys are. And that's actually a good thing. So like, don't try to cheat people to make money, okay? This isn't a recommendation. All right, and I think this is really our second tip of the day, if you're writing this down, which I see none of you are, and you're just going to try to remember this the rest of your life. So that's cool. Anyhow, the second tip that you have for today is not to value sneakiness. You know what I mean? Like, don't value sneakiness. Like, we can value intelligence, but sometimes I think we admire the sneaks in our world who are cheating the government, especially if it's a big corporation or the government. We kind of admire them. I think I might have told you about my laundromat rental thing that I bought the other day, a few months ago from Daniel, actually has two water inputs. And the last landlord figured she could turn off one of the inputs or almost turn it off, so it looked as though the laundromat actually wasn't using any water. And the other water was still coming from the town because it's an old building and it's kind of weird. And she said to me, that's okay because, of course, it's the government and there's, you know, they don't deserve my money. That's wrong. Don't do that, by the way. That's not a recommendation for you. Okay, so don't be sneaky. All right, I know, it's sad. I'll make it quicker. Verse 9, Jesus gives another illustration of the parable. So he's given you this guy, this tricky manager, he's cheating, and he gives a couple applications immediately, and then he explains it all. Here's the second application. Make friends by bribing them. Verse 9, I tell you, make friends for yourselves by means of unrighteous wealth, so that when it fails you, they may receive you into eternal blessings, eternal dwellings, rather. So, another nugget of wisdom from the topic itself. This is a difficult but memorable verse. Like, this is one of the verses that I remember without trying to memorize it because it's so counterintuitive. Like, if you bribe people, they'll be your friends, kind of. Right? I don't know if those people that this guy bribed were his friends, like he'd hang out with them and play settlers and stuff like that, but they liked him, and he's like, hey, you do that too. So that's another way that Jesus says things that are memorable, but clearly you don't actually want to do that. The first thing about this is which kinds of friends can welcome you into eternal dwellings? Only God can do that. Right? Only God can do that. But take your dough and be sneaky with it. How can you be sneaky with your money but in a positive way? Well, you can be generous with it, right? You can give it to people. You can make it so that the way you view it as is not just a way to make myself feel happy and secure all the time, but as a tool for good purposes. For looking after my family and stuff, sure. But I can use it to bless others. I can use it as a tool of serving God. The little phrase has stuck with me for many years. I can tell where you're at spiritually by your calendar and your checkbook. You know, you can talk a good talk, but if your dough is saying a different story, maybe you don't really believe all this super duper. So you have to understand the wording of all this is derived from the parable. When he says, you know, make friends by unrighteous wealth, like money, just common money, he's not saying actually go out and bribe people. He's saying, you know, he's just, because the last guy did that, the unrighteous steward did that, and he's saying, you know, you can be sneaky with your money too, but in a cool way where you do things with God by using it in good, interesting ways. So in other words, by using our money generously and in the ways God wants us to, kind of makes us friends with God. It doesn't mean everybody's saved who gives money to UNICEF and stuff like that, but that's the kind of thing that you should do if you're following the Lord. Okay, and finally we come to the lesson that comes out of this, because some parables have an explanation of themselves, and this one has an explanation of itself. Verse 10, one who is faithful in a very little is also faithful in much. And one who is dishonest in a very little is also dishonest in much. If then you have not been faithful in the unrighteous wealth, who will entrust to you the true riches? And if you have not been faithful in that which is another's, who will give you that which is your own? So finally, the thievery of the manager is exposed as evil. One who is faithful in a very little is also faithful in much, and one who is dishonest in very little is also dishonest in much. So faithful doesn't so mean like believing in God, it's just acting honestly in all the ways that you do it. The thing is, I suppose we can show how much we believe in God by our behaviors, not by our feelings. You notice the accounts manager kind of got himself to the point where he could feel okay about stealing all that dough? Like in the end, if you'd say to him, was what you're doing bad? And he'd say, oh, what's bad? You know, I have to do this, right? So he got to the point of feeling good about what he was going to do. The thing is, in the New Testament, the mind and the will is where faithfulness occurs, rather than in the emotions. So faithfulness occurs in your decision-making and in your heart, which is to say, why I'm doing something, rather than how I feel about it. So, you know, you may be able to talk yourself into feeling good about something that's actually wrong, but at some point you've made a decision to do that up here in the brain. And that's what seems to be important to God, is you doing right or wrong, not how you feel about the right or wrong you're going to do. You need to be faithful in little things. Here's the third tip today of stuff we need to do. Faithful in little things, literally in the littlest of things. That's when you need to start doing what's right. Some people say things like, yeah, okay, I sinned, or I made a mistake, or I, you know, whatever, I wasn't kind to my wife, or, you know, you go ahead and name something. But I didn't rob a bank, did I? You ever heard that I didn't rob a bank illustration? Well, I didn't rob a bank. I'm not that, in other words, I'm not that bad a person. Which in the great scheme of things, I don't know that robbing a bank is the worst possible thing you can do, by the way. But anyhow, that's the illustration that people choose. Here he says, like, okay, what you need to do is to do right in the very smallest of decisions. Get on that. Like the next time you come across some choice you got to make that's about doing right or doing wrong, and it's a little decision, I want you to pay a special attention to that. That's the time where you got to be on and make the right decision. Is it on your taxes? Everyone's done their taxes by now, hopefully. But is there some little area you could kind of lie in on your taxes? You know, I just didn't mention the income from this area, and they'll probably never check. It'll be okay. Well, that little decision, I know you're just ripping off the government, they're not going to go broke or anything like that, but the next time you come to that little decision, you do what's right at that point. And then all the big ones end up taking care of themselves, don't they? Like, why are you religious guys so keen on doing everything right? Why don't you let some things slide once in a while? Well, it's because if you start getting in your head that some things are you're able to slide, let go, and be dishonest in, then sure enough, sooner or later, even the big things you're going to be dishonest in. And secondly, God's interested in what? A little bit of money you give to the government, does he care about that? Does he have an investment in the government? No, he doesn't. He cares about this thing. He cares about your heart. And the trick is, when you cheat in a little bit, you've made a heart decision to cheat. You've made a heart decision to do what's wrong. And that's what God's all interested in. He's not so worried about the amounts and stuff like that. It's what's really going on inside of you, and that's what he's really interested in. What's going on inside of me? So, the tip to pay special attention when we're about to do, let's say, for example, a white lie. White lie. Allie, what's a white lie again? Is that a racist thing or like a... No. Oh, okay. All right, yeah. You know, a lie that you don't think will hurt anybody and that isn't very overtly beneficial to you, that I'm okay in doing that. Well, the next time you're about to tell a white lie, catch yourself. By the way, just for the record, if you're hiding a bunch of Jews and the Nazis come to your door and they say, are there any Jews here? You go ahead and say, nope. Just greater good, principle of the greater good. Okay? So just, you heard it here first. Anyhow, that's debatable. Some people debate that, ethicists debate that. I'm just going to go ahead and say, sometimes you let it go. But I'll tell you what, most of the time, the vast majority of the time, you're not harboring endangered Jews and saving their lives. What you're doing is probably like that thing about cheating the government or whatever, Like if you go to the counter and you should be paying $10 for an item, but they accidentally only charge you $5, you go ahead and tell them, I should have paid $10, because that's pretty little, right? Okay, finally, does God have any role in my money? The application part. My grandpa once said to me, how much of your stuff is God's? Like, how much of it do you give to God? He wasn't particularly religious, and I was going to become a preacher and stuff. I said, well, all of it's God's. It's all his. I just use some of it. Sometimes I can afford to tithe more. Sometimes I can afford to tithe less and give it back directly. But it's all his stuff. In the Old Testament, when God, when the people had kind of, the Israelites kind of made a theocracy where God was in charge of the land, and he gave a bunch of laws about how to run the land himself. One of the things he said was in Leviticus 25, it said, the land must not be sold permanently because the land is mine. And you're just aliens and my tenants. Right? So if you owned a farm, it's like, yeah, you can live there. In fact, you can live there all your life and pass it on to your kids. But technically, it's all mine. And you can't sell it. You can kind of rent it to people. That's how people got away with doing that. Rent it for long periods of time. But it's all mine. Jesus said something similar in Luke 14, verse 33. In the same way, any of you who does not give up everything he has cannot be my disciple. Uh-oh. You better give all your money away by the end of the day, I guess, otherwise you're not going to heaven. Is that what he meant? Well, no, not exactly. But if you consider it your stuff rather than God's stuff, maybe you know, either you're thinking wrong or you're not really following. There was a guy named John Wesley. He started a big denomination, became the Methodist Church, an Englishman in the 1700s. Wesley watched his house burn down, which wasn't that uncommon in the old 1700s. He watched his house burn down, and then he said, well, God, that's one less house you have. And I wrote that down years ago, but now that I've owned a couple houses, I'm not sure I could say that in here. I think I'd be like, wow, I sure hope they put that out. And did I get all my stuff out? And I sure am glad most of my information is up on the cloud because I'm a teacher and information is, you know, valuable to me. That's one less house you have, God. Right? What difference would it make? Like, what would it look like for me to do that, to get to that point where I could say all my stuff is God's, and I'm just using it. I'm just renting it, right? I remember the first church I was a solo minister in many moons ago when the world was young. Dinosaurs roamed the earth like kings. As a minister. Little church in southern Manitoba. And it was weird because I think in my heart and heart, I decided that I owned it. Like, I think that's the ownership I took of it, is that I owned the building. And, of course, it wasn't too many years later that we moved away. And I learned that lesson that I don't own anything. Obviously, I didn't own the church, but I think part of me thought that somehow, if you can get your head around that. I really connected with it. And then the next church I went to, I said, it was a much nicer building, by the way. And I just said, you know what? I'm the senior minister. I'm the main guy here. But I don't own this place. I'm just passing through. I'm glad it's a pretty sanctuary. It had a gym. Had all kinds of cool stuff. It was in a beautiful area. But I'm just using it for a little while, and it's going to be returned again. Well, can I say that with the rest of my stuff? I like that phrase, you know, do you own your money or does your money own you? That's a good little proverb. finally, to illustrate all of that, you have to understand the Bible teaches not that money is evil. Now, where in the Bible does it say money is evil? It says the love of money is the root of all evil. Somehow having stuff and taking it as my identity, and that's who I am, and that's my main deal in life, that leads to the wrong path. I illustrated this years ago with this story, and I'll wrap up with this one. Imagine the whole world is a big pool of money. Loonies. Not that plastic garbage that the government gives you. Real money. Loony dollars. You walk outside instead of the grass, right? It's a pool of dough. And just like a regular pool, it gets deeper and deeper. And you can't avoid it. You've got to go out into it. So you go out into it, but you don't have to get immersed in it. You have to be part of it, but you don't have to get yourself immersed in it. Unfortunately, some people are doing just exactly that. Instead of just walking around and dealing with the money, they're actually kind of swimming in it. Some of them are dangling their legs in it, and some of them are a little farther up, and some are up to their neck in the money. Now, I don't know if you ever put your hand in a big bucket of loonies. I was a little kid, and my grandpa was a bus driver, and what he liked to do was collect coins. And so he'd give us all the coins he didn't want to collect, just like pennies and loonies or quarters and stuff like that. And I had a big jar of it, and I was a little kid. So one day I just kind of moved it around so my whole hand was in there. I'll never forget how much weight, I don't know if you ever tried this, but it puts a lot of weight on you. Like you can feel it, like it's and it's hard to get your hand out. Well, I've never done this, and I'm just guessing, but if you were actually to immerse yourself in coins, in a pool, like after a while, probably after a short while, it'd be pretty hard to breathe, I figure. And, you know, so you see people, and they're out up to their neck in money, and you're a Christian, and what you want to do is you go out to them and say, you know what, you are taking this way too seriously. Your stuff is starting to own you, like it's getting your heart. You're not just dealing with it and making transactions, but you are immersed in this, right? And I imagine you have to put on a kind of snowshoe if you're walking on a bunch of loonies, so that you wouldn't. All right, that's what I think anyhow. It'd be weird, but you do that, and wouldn't it be strange if the person looks up at you, and instead of saying, you know what, you're right, this thing's crushing me, why don't you let me out of here? He says to you, you know what, you're just after my money. You religious guys, you're just after my money. I'm not going to give it up. You try to explain you don't want him to give up his money. You want that person not to have it as their main thing in life, that their heart is given there. But it's so hard to tell someone that once their heart's been given over to the pursuit of stuff. And it may look really different. I don't mean everyone's trying to collect stocks and bonds. Like, everyone has a different thing that money manifests itself in, right? In toys, in cars, ATVs, clothes, iPads. I love using this thing. It's great. Super helpful for teaching. It's got like a dozen Bibles on it. If I wanted to, I could use it on the Apple TV. That's how I teach. But what if I just got into that, like that can easily start to own your heart. And that's what the Lord doesn't want us to do. Okay, I just want to close off with a proverb. One of the end proverbs at the end of the book, why is this not working? End of the book of Proverbs says this. It's a summary for the guy's life. He says, keep falsehood and lies far from me. Give me neither poverty nor riches, he says to God. But give me only my daily bread. Otherwise, I may have too much and disown you and say, who's the Lord? Or I may become poor and steal and so dishonor the name of my God. Let's close in prayer. God, we thank you that you grant us wealth sometimes. You grant us help in many ways. And God, we just pray for the grace today as we go out into our lives, that we'd be honest in all of our dealings, even when it seems like there's no victim, and that we'd be willing to say that the most important thing to us is knowing you, loving those around us, and living faithful lives. Help us, Lord, to see the places where we are giving our heart to our stuff and grant us the freedom from it. In Jesus' name.
All right, thank you, Jason. I invite you to stand with us.